Day, I want to call our attention to the 62nd Psalm. Psalm 62 is a psalm that needs to be read repeatedly among God's people because it's one of the psalms of unbroken trust. It's not that Psalm 62 ignores any of the pressures that we as God's people find ourselves facing in the world. It's just that there's never an occasion in this psalm where there's anything but the expression of trust in the Lord. One of the key words in this psalm is only, or alone, or one. It's used six times as the first word in different verses of this psalm. The idea of waiting in silence for Him is prominent in this psalm. It's the way trust it demonstrates itself. It doesn't mean that someone just sits without saying anything, because the psalm itself is an expression of trust and it says something. What it means is, I am committed to the Lord in such a way that I have an inner stillness or a quietness in the middle of the noise of life. And then please notice, before we work our way through, that there will be a very profound contrast in this little psalm. It's a contrast between the trust in Him at all times of verse 8 here, which we have before us tonight, and pouring your heart out before Him on the one hand, and on the other hand, in verse 10, trusting in extortion or vain hopes or robbery. It's the idea on the one hand of trusting in the faithfulness of God, and on the other hand, trusting in things that can't possibly last and things that may have been obtained and may have originated with deceitfulness themselves. It's a matter of what we put our hopes in. Now, having said that, let's think for just a moment our way through this psalm. It starts with what we could call a confession. A confession not of, like we sometimes think of it, of something that we've done wrong, but more in the nature of the good confession, and admitting that I am a believer in the Lord and that I depend on Him. And this is something that is done in the middle of a situation where not everybody does. Really, in the first four verses, the confession that the writer makes expresses the two different, I guess you could say, forces which are operating around him in his life. On the one hand, verses 1 and 2 is his expression of his trust in God. For God alone my soul waits in silence. From Him comes my salvation. He alone is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be greatly shaken. Now think of what he's telling us here in this. His soul is stilled and calmed and at peace in God alone. He waits for God, for what comes from God in verse 1, and God turns out to be who he waits for in verse 2. Salvation here means that he has a rock, that he has a fortress, and he has something in his life that will not allow him to fall. A rock, a fortress, and I'll not be greatly shaken. That's the eye of faith. That's how things look to someone who trusts in God alone. On the other hand, there's how he looks in the eyes of other people. It's how they view him in verses 3 and 4. This is a part of his confession. How long will all of you attack a man to batter him? like a leaning wall, a tottering fence. They only plan to thrust him down from his high position. They take pleasure in falsehood. They bless with their mouths, but inwardly they curse. Notice here that this whole thing is built on things not being what they seem, operating around people who say one thing with their mouths and mean something else toward the writer of this psalm in their hearts. The people that he deals with here regard him as being like a leaning wall. Have you ever had a fence? We had a wood fence one time, a wood post in the ground that were not treated properly, and over time they decayed, and one day the wind came and that fence, which had been going like this, went like that. This man who waits for God alone looks to the world around him like a tottering, a leaning wall or a tottering fence. And they not only expect him to fall, but they think he will. He says he won't be greatly shaken because God is his rock, and they say he's going to fall. We know he will. There's nothing to the one he believes in. You ever find yourself in that situation? What you confess versus what people around you in the world think will happen to you. All right, this confession now turns into instruction. First for himself and then for, maybe we could say, the whole congregation, all the people around. For himself, he says, "For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence." Verse 5, wait a minute. I thought he said in verse 1, "For God alone, my soul waits." Now he says, "For God alone, O my soul, wait." He's having to remind himself or to reaffirm or to restate to himself what it is he really believes in. Isn't that kind of like what we're going to do in a few moments around the Lord's table? Aren't all of us who one time stood up and said with our friends present, "I believe Jesus Christ is the Son of God," about to say the same thing and about to remind ourselves in this new week that that's what everything is about for us? "For God alone, O my soul, wait in silence, for my hope is from Him." And then notice he uses the pronoun "my," and then five or six different ways God had revealed Himself in the history of Israel to His people. "He only is my rock and my salvation, my fortress. I shall not be shaken." You got to remember what everybody else is saying about him. "On God rest my salvation and my glory. My mighty rock, my refuge is God." So here's he saying, God is my, what did he say? My rock, salvation, fortress, glory, refuge. All of that. That's what I depend on. That's what my soul is calmed by. That's what I hope in. And then he turns to his brothers and sisters. And he encourages them, or instructs them, we could say, "Trust in Him at all times, O people. Pour out your heart before Him." There would be an illustration of what it would mean to trust Him. Who's your heart turned to, and who do you pour out the cares of your heart to? God is a refuge for us. A refuge being like a place of safety or a place of salvation and calm. "Those of low estate," this would be people of low estate, of humble origin, "are but a breath," like all humans. "Those of high estate are a delusion. in the balances, they go up. They are together lighter than a breath. Put no trust in extortion. Set no vain hopes on robbery. If riches increase, set not your heart on them. You might be tempted by the people who think you as a believer are only like a leaning fence or a tottering wall. You might be tempted to try to find security where they find theirs, either in wealth or in power or some other vain hope like that. The images in verse 9 here are the same kinds of images, interestingly, that James uses in the New Testament to remind us not to become falsely secure and not to think that somehow or another we can make our lives here something that never will change. In James chapter 1, what is it, verses 9, 10, 11, along in there, it's like the flower of a plant that blossoms and then looks so good but just withers and dies. In James chapter 4, verse 14, it's like the vapor or the mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. And what the psalmist is saying is you can't, don't let anybody mislead you about what the leaning fence or tottering wall is. You can put your trust in the Lord, and that can still be standing when all the rest of this has faded away or withered up. And so then what starts out as a confession and then turns into instruction becomes a commitment. Not commitment that's like where we say, look how great we are, how strong our commitment is, but instead entrusting ourselves to the care of the God who's great enough. And look at the way this happens in verses 11 and 12. Once God has spoken, twice have I heard this. As near as I can tell from the Old Testament, that's a way of saying this is something God has said and done, and it's certain. This is something you can count on. That power belongs to God, that to you, O Lord, notice he's committing himself to God now, belongs steadfast love, for you will render to a man according to his work. Now think about this. This is the commitment of trust. First, that God is powerful enough. The power belongs to him. He's able. He can do. If you think of how important this becomes in the New Testament, how our believing God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think becomes. And then secondly, God is a God of steadfast love or of loyal love or of faithful love. He will want to be our salvation. He's shown that in what we're going to remember here in a few minutes. Steadfast love belongs to him. He'll keep his covenant. He will want to bless us. He'll care for his children. And then third, God will be just. For you will render to a man according to his work. I tried to look this up. I found at least 10 places in the New Testament where almost that same wording is found. Jesus said it in Matthew 16 after they confessed him. And then you get finally to the end of the story, and when we're looking forward to his vindicating the cause of our faith, we still are looking toward this idea. And then when we're examining ourselves and whether our love is loyal like our Father's love is, it's the fact that we all must appear before the judgment seat of Christ to give answer for the things done in our bodies. It's this idea. God is powerful, he's loving, he's just, Let's commit our cause to Him. And in our case, that's based on the fact of what He's already done for us. So, you think of trust in this God, not in this is what's real, not all the other things around. Let's make that confession, try to encourage each other, and in so doing, commit our cause to Heavenly Father's care today.